Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to the studio at the Media Research Center, where we hope to live up to that middle name, to do our research on the media. Sometimes when you read Newsbusters, it might seem like the Media Anecdote Center. Doing those individual items, that's what brings the clicks. Did you see what happened today? But we are always trying to look at the bigger picture, to note the trends and the patterns and the tricks, and occasionally a treat or two. I wanted to start today with the Washington Post trying to assess the legacy of Meghan McCain on The View on ABC. The television critic was named Ingu Kang. She's new. She started in June. So she first asked the question, was Meghan McCain good for the show? She gave that a hearty yes. But why was that? Well, because apparently every show needs a villain. She wrote, McCain made for a highly effective heel, a love-to-hate reality villain who brought a badly needed wild card energy to the show and whose best moments came from needling the other panelists or puncturing their idealism or self-righteousness. This is where the Washington Post should never deny that they're just a gaggle of liberals and leftists. Meghan McCain was a love-to-hate villain? What? To many of us, she was the conquering hero. And it's kind of funny because, you know, Meghan McCain's appointment back in 2015 felt more like ABC was going to go to another Nicole Wallace, if you don't remember her on The View, another Abby Huntsman, someone who would be considered a CNN Republican or MSNBC Republican, somebody who was not really a Fox News type. In Meghan McCain's case, it sounded like someone to the left of the Bush family. Think about that in 2015. To be fair, I mean, Meghan McCain was John McCain's daughter. That's who she was. She was contrarian. She was, at best, a liberal Republican. She was the kind of Republican Rachel Maddow liked. Rachel Maddow had a very supportive interview with Meghan McCain in 2010, where they talked about all of her disgusting male critics who questioned her weight. Well, there's lots of critics of Meghan McCain who said nothing about her appearance. I wrote up that interview. But we were quite surprised with what we got when Meghan McCain came to The View, and maybe others were as well, is that she was pretty much a conservative on the show. She was quite explicitly anti-Trump, but she was the one that when a liberal or a Democrat would come on the show, you would expect they were going to actually get a half-decent grilling from Meghan McCain. And so it did make for a good show. It also made for rockin' content, rockin' anecdotes at Newsbusters. But Ingu Kang at the Washington Post, this really got me. McCain was never the show's most persistent critic of the previous administration, the Trumps. That title rightfully belongs to Joy Behar. Well, great. Then, Sonny Hostin, a former prosecutor, is the intellectual heavyweight. Well, next to Joy Behar, I mean, Joy Reid's an intellectual heavyweight. I mean, everybody's an intellectual heavyweight next to Joy Behar. Joy Behar's there as comic relief. They think it's because she's funny. We think it's because she's ridiculous. And then Whoopi Goldberg, according to the Post critic, was the show's common sense voice. And then Sarah Haynes was the normcore mom next door. Ingu Kang continues, McCain felt very much herself, for better or for worse. Smart, snotty, cranky, wonky, sharp-elbowed, self-absorbed, well-connected, even cosmopolitan in her own sheltered way. She didn't speak for all Republicans, describing herself as a conservative first and a GOP member second. Nor did she seem to care much for a natural ally like Never Trumper Anna Navarro. Oh yes, Anna Navarro. She has so much in common with other Republicans. Kang pointed out, McCain made headlines in 2019 for asking Navarro why, given her pro-DACA stance, she's even a Republican. Yes. Note to Washington Post, Anna Navarro is not a Republican. It's like saying Zell Miller was a Democrat after he showed up at the Republican convention in 2004 and made fun of John Kerry for wanting to defend America with spitballs. The Washington Post continued, the 36-year-old McCain could sound a scathingly petulant 16 or an irreparably curmudgeonly 76. Well, that doesn't sound complimentary on either end. Why don't you just let her be 36? Joy Behar, she's an irreparably curmudgeonly 76 or something. She's the one that grosses everyone out by talking about how sexy Bernie Sanders is. Then Kang wrote, as a pundit, McCain was seldom convincing on the strength of her ideas.
Because we're all liberals.
But she was excellent at piercing the liberal bubble her co-hosts tended to build around themselves. Well, yeah, that's what the show has always been. And it is one of those things that makes the show more interesting when you've got somebody that can mix it up. This is why Nicole Wallace flopped on The View, because Nicole Wallace didn't really want to disagree with her liberal pals. She was really headed toward MSNBC. So Ingu Kang, how liberal is she? Well, I went to her Twitter just for fun, just to get a clue. And she retweeted New Yorker TV critic Emily Nussbaum, who's quite a lib. She's a liberal Democrat campaign donor, as I recall. But she retweeted Emily Nussbaum, the fact that we can't even get people to take life-saving vaccines doesn't give me hope about anyone uniting to save the planet. All right, so that's your climate change wallow of the day. Eagle-eyed Christine Marsh here has been our resident daily analyst of The View. She will surely also have a take on the Washington Post retrospective of Meghan McCain later on Newsbusters. Now, I just have to talk to you for a second about Jeopardy. Don't we all love Jeopardy? Can't America unite behind Jeopardy? Well, not anymore. CNN's media unit has a piece up ripping how Jeopardy got the host decision so wrong. That was the headline. Their writer, Allison Morrow, concluded with this sentence. The choice of yet another white man, who also happens to be an insider of elite TV media, sends a clear message. The boys are not ready to hand over the keys yet. And no amount of public shaming or appeals to diversity can convince them that they should. Who died and made the liberals in charge of appointing everyone on television? And can't we turn this around on CNN? Dear Allison Morrow, why don't you tell Jeff Zucker he shouldn't have his job because he's an insider of elite TV media and he's just another white guy? Where was the story on CNN when CNN picked just another white guy, Brian Stelter, to replace white guy Howard Kurtz in 2013? There was no headline about how that was so wrong, even though I think we all know it was. Allison Morrow at CNN said, fans felt they deserved a fair and transparent process. Yeah, what these people all wanted was Twitter is going to pick who hosts Jeopardy. Come on. You know, why don't we let the actual people who own these shows and produce these shows and profit from these shows try to make a decision where they think their show is going to continue to be a profit machine? But Allison Morrow wrote, the genius of Jeopardy has always been its relatively low-stakes, politically neutral format that let viewers at home play along. Okay, then stop politicizing the Jeopardy decision here, where she's comparing it to Dick Cheney appointing himself vice president. Naturally, this millennial writer was rooting for LeVar Burton because he's a male of color, and she grew up watching Reading Rainbow. Now, I'm sure that would be fine, too. I don't think that that would be bad. I don't think if you watch these guest hosts on Jeopardy, I didn't see them all, The show goes on. The host doesn't matter a tremendous amount. I mean, honestly, the people who write the questions are probably more important to making the show be what it has always been. I just get tired of the liberals, always with this hectoring, always with this idea of, oh no, another white man got a job. Then the Jeopardy people decided, well, we're going to hire Mayim Bialik to host specials and whatnot, so we can have a female too. Here, there's a nod to diversity. Well, of course, Alison Morrow at CNN wasn't going to have that either. Bialik has her own controversies over the years. She's been accused of being an anti-vaxxer, although she received the COVID vaccine. She also apologized in 2017 for an op-ed in the New York Times that suggested conservative clothing and modesty could help prevent women in Hollywood from being sexually assaulted. This is what they're digging up. This is somehow going to keep you from getting a prestigious job in TV because you stuck up for modesty in Hollywood. Are you serious? She continues, no one's perfect, certainly. But in the social media age, it's confounding that Jeopardy seems to have failed to anticipate any of this backlash. Or if they did anticipate it, they didn't care. And I honestly can't decide which is more offensive. Can you just smell the self-appointment here? Just the utter entitled nature of Alison Morrow? You're too easily offended. If it offends you, the Jeopardy selection process was offended. Why don't you go try being offended by Chris Cuomo's memos to his brother? Trash the accusers! Trash the accusers! They're all whores! Oh, Alison Morrow doesn't object to that because she's an employee of CNN. She is, how does that go again? She's an elite insider in TV. It's just annoying. CNN, get out of everybody else's business about who gets a job at CNN or at Jeopardy. We're not telling you who to replace at CNN with somebody else. Have you been to CNSnews.com lately? Our sister site has the latest reporting and conservative commentary. Have you read Terry Jeffrey, the top editor over there? Terry defines the word wonky. You can get a Terry Jeffrey seminar just walking to the kitchen in here. So make sure you can check out CNSnews.com. Okay, the column today is on how Joe and Mika and Joy Reid and Eugene Robinson Space Modulator can say terrible things about Ron DeSantis or Greg Abbott. And nobody checks them. These Republican governors are apparently murdering people. And the independent fact checkers are like, what? You can go back and you go to PolitiFact and look up and see. Mika Brzezinski has one fact check, all right? And it's like 7 years old. Joy Reid and Joe Scarbo don't have a fact check since 2018. Both of them got a mostly true in 2018, all right? Eugene Robinson has two mostly trues on PolitiFact. So that's the reality. You can call Ron DeSantis is a murderer, and PolitiFact goes, fair comment. Yeah, Joy Reid unloaded the garbage pail on August 10. She asked the question, gosh, it was a little bit leading and tilted. What is the strategy behind killing children in your own state and letting children die of COVID? And then she called him Governor Death Santis and talked about his partner in carnage, Greg Abbott. Come on. Curtis Houck was sending us transcripts of the latest in his email. Joy Reid, these are nonsensical, homicidal arguments against their own voters. Being against mask mandates for school kids. Charlie Sykes then added, political tribalism is a hell of a drug. Yeah, he said this on MSNBC. So if you come up with the wrong argument on COVID, where you actually suggest that maybe we shouldn't be on permanent lockdown, and maybe not everybody needs to wear a mask outside their homes 24 hours a day, you're called homicidal. Sometimes they call you terrorists on Joy Reid's show. August 11, her guest Malcolm Nance insisted the Republican Party were terrorists like ISIS or vanilla ISIS. Yuck, yuck. Al-Qaeda, or the Irish Republican Army. You know, see, Curtis Houck did a whole takedown on Malcolm Nance being a nun, just a numbskull, fighting with Ben Shapiro on The Real Life with Bill Maher show. Then, of course, on MSNBC, there was Miles Taylor, which we call Captain Anonymous. He was allowed to write an anonymous anti-Trump op-ed, The New York Times, and even wrote a book as Anonymous. They thought he was an important old figure. He wasn't. He was an insignificant, stupid young figure. Stupid? That's a little strong. No. Here's what he said the other day on the Nicole Wallace show. You're going to see that because radicalized elements of the Republican Party now represent a bigger threat to our democracy than organizations like Al-Qaeda or ISIS ever did. What? So, of course, yes, what he's projecting is, he's projecting that somehow elements of the Republican Party are going to kill 3,000 Americans and take down the World Trade Center and take out half the Pentagon. Really? But the fact checkers can't get involved. Now, humor me for a minute or a few minutes. One of the hobby horses I ride here at the MRC is picking on public broadcasting. This is my gig. This is my alley. Since the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, in other words, most of my life, we've been subjected to taxpayer-subsidized left-wing propaganda on PBS and NPR. Now, I have people here, Jeffrey Dickens tells me, Graham, don't write about PBS. That's boring to everybody. You put PBS in the headline, nobody clicks. Well, we're going to be bold and daring and do it because it's outrageous that our tax dollars go to this stuff and we can't demand some fairness and some balance on television and radio networks that we pay for. So this became evident again. There was an interview on the Reliable Sources podcast. Brian Stelter talked to a woman named Kelly McBride. Kelly McBride is an executive at the Poynter Institute. How liberal is that? Well, they run PolitiFact. All right. They are the liberal media. But she's also been named the public editor at NPR as sort of her sideline. So they're discussing what kind of letters and what kind of comments Kelly McBride is taking from the public about what's wrong with NPR. She did admit that overwhelmingly the number one message is about bias, whether the bias is too liberal or too conservative.
There's a wide spectrum of complaints, including, I just want to underscore, that NPR is too conservative.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I probably get that more. I mean, so there's two categories of listeners, right? Or of complainers who write in. One category is people who are clearly NPR listeners, right? And they demonstrate that by their familiarity with the product.
Right. Yeah.
Those people probably are more likely to complain that NPR is too conservative or too moderate. And then there is another type of letter writer that usually is being inspired by some outside critic of NPR. And they, you can tell by their letters, I can tell by their letters, that they aren't really listening to NPR. They are complaining because NPR symbolizes something to them in this political environment.
Look, I want to improve NPR. But my idea of improvement is more balance, more conservative counterpoints. And to them, inside NPR, that's ruining it and enraging their base. You can hear it right there in what she's saying. And that is the people who are really familiar with NPR are all radical left AOC fans. We can't upset them. They think NPR is too conservative. Well, if you don't listen to NPR, 5 minutes in most any newscast is going to give you a clue about how liberal they are, okay? And even if they're not outrageously liberal biased, everything that they care about is a liberal concern or a concept. It's dramatically liberal. So if you think it's too conservative, you're on the cuckoo scale. Anyway, they're never going to try to balance out NPR to make it more balanced. They think that ruins it. And so they're going to say, when conservatives write in and say, we think we deserve a fair shot, We think, gosh, it was unfair when your commentator compared the NRA to the Negro Removal Association. That actually happened on NPR. We sort of objected to your segment where you said, I hope people who think they're going to be raptured actually make the planet a better place by, vanishing, something to that effect. I mean, there's been just some outrageous junk on NPR. And when you object to it, well, they just don't really care. Now, the other part of this that really upsets me is the idea that they're saying, well, conservative critics of NPR just don't listen. They're not listeners. They just got some snippet from Rush Limbaugh or something. Well, I listen to NPR during my commute quite a lot. It's called being a workaholic or a self-loathing conservative. Maybe both. And yes, I am looking for things to write up. And it can be hard to find because everything's liberal. How do you pick? And, you know, look, sometimes when I'm doing that, I get better informed. Sometimes I get entertained. Like, I like the NPR music features, for example, you know, as long as they're not, you know, and now folk songs of the Cuban Revolution. But usually it's stuff like this. You know, NPR had an interview with John Kerry about climate. That's not a challenging interview. Right? So people come on to talk about climate from the Biden administration, and it's just, it's not an interview. It's a facilitation. And tell us more about what you're doing to save the planet. But to Stelter and Callie McBride, conservative critics, well, they're just not serious.
I like the way you structure that. I think I need to recognize that in the emails I get as well, because there's definitely a cohort that is reacting to a critic of CNN or a critic of what something I've said on CNN that's been, you know, snipped and shared in a 30-second clip. And those people are writing in about that clip. They're not writing in about CNN as a whole.
Right. And it's not a genuine criticism, right? That's what on my team, we talk about this a lot. Is this person genuinely interested in improving NPR, or are they just taking a swipe because that fits into a political perspective for them?
Yeah. It's complicated. And there's so many, especially when you're getting that volume of feedback, you've got to look for that good faith feedback and see where you can actually make a difference.
Especially in this role, right? If the job is to communicate, to be a bridge between the audience and NPR, and to, through that communication, coach NPR to achieve its own internally stated goals. It doesn't help to just be magnifying disingenuous criticism.
Well, there it is again, Brian Stelter saying that conservative criticism as a whole is bad faith criticism. And it's really kind of amazing for Kelly McBride to say, you know, I'm there to improve NPR by their own goals, their own internal goals. Well, yeah, their own internal goals is to be a liberal sandbox, a liberal propaganda outlet. But for her to say, oh, I'm not here to magnify disingenuous criticism, just like Stelter, she's suggesting all conservative criticism is disingenuous. Now, okay, maybe she's saying conservatives are out to damage the brand of NPR, and their brand is civility and reasonableness and intelligent conversation. Well, yeah, that doesn't hold up outside their liberal bubble, you know? You can sound perfectly calm when everyone agrees with each other. So what you have here, in a nutshell, you go back to the idea of the dueling pressures on national public radio. And it's really true for journalism as a whole. The right is asking for balance, for some semblance of, you have a show called All Things Considered. Why don't you try considering all things? And the left wants the opposite. The left wants, don't be moderate, don't balance, don't try to be nice, call the Republicans killers, censor their viewpoints, crush them. Now, the point of this podcast with Stelter, the news item, the hook, was NPR allowing their journalists to protest in the streets. Inside there, they're especially under pressure from minority and LGBTQIA plus journalists who want to march against the police or they want to go to the Pride Parade. So NPR dresses those up as, quote unquote, upholding human dignity. like it's not controversial or political or ideological. I would suggest that the annual for March for Life against abortion is about upholding human dignity. But inside NPR, that's where scary teenage kids in MAGA hats go to be racists. Kelly McBride sort of summarized the whole thing, saying it's just silly to suggest we are somehow these humans who have no opinions, no life experience that would inform those opinions. Of course, we all have life experiences, and that makes the journalism richer, especially when we have a diverse group of people creating the journalism. No, you're not diverse, and you're not making journalism richer with your life experience because you don't have any life experience inside, you know, a Catholic church or inside an evangelical church. That's what you don't have. You don't have experience being a dairy farmer in western Wisconsin or something. Farming the corn in Iowa. But, you know, that's okay. They have a great diversity of opinion among people that live in Manhattan, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. In CNN's podcast summary, they highlighted that Kelly McBride thinks restricting minority journalists from activism is harming them. Quote, when you talk to journalists of color who are trying to make their way in American newsrooms, they are disproportionately harmed by these conflict of interest policies. So we have to have special rules because minority journalists aren't really journalists until they can be fully human. That's the way they talk about this. They should be able to burn down drugstores at night and then come in the morning and report on the defund the police rally. Okay, I'm exaggerating. My point is, if you go to the mostly peaceful BLM protests, you're probably not going to want to talk about the violent parts of the BLM protests because you're thinking, that's ruining what we turned out into the streets to accomplish. You're invested. Now, to some extent, you could say, Tim, it doesn't make much difference whether they protest or not, because if you actually listen to NPR, these other networks, they're not exactly hiding their politics, which I suppose is true. But every time we try to object to an idea like, oh, yes, reporters should just really go out and protest in the streets, we're trying to uphold some idea that, yeah, reporting is something that's supposed to be different than activism. Journalism is supposed to be something that's separate from scribbling slogans on a placard. And that's just not where we are today. What we have is a diverse set of liberals who say they're for diversity and inclusion. And at NPR and these other places, diversity means uniformity of thought, diversity of races and genders and sexualities. Inclusion doesn't mean including conservatives. Inclusion means we're going to not tolerate intolerant people. You get a self-reinforcing liberal bubble, and they take our money to make that bubble. That's what we object to. So if you actually find it somewhat fascinating to see what we're finding on NPR or the PBS NewsHour, it's here at Newsbusters and lots of other stuff. Come once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks for listening.